Mama who bore me, Mama who gave me, Mama the angels who made me so sad. Mama who bore me, Mama who gave me, no way to handle things, who made me so sad. Mama the weeping, Mama the angels, no sleep in heaven or Bethlehem.
Rock musicals never seem to quite satisfy anyone. Rock lovers think they sound too much like Broadway, and Broadway musical lovers think that they're not enough like Broadway. So how do you explain the almost unanimous praise for Spring Awakening? The New York Times' Christopher Isherwood wrote that, after it, Broadway may never be the same. And another reviewer raved, if we're very lucky, once in a generation, an unexpected new musical comes along and changes everything. That is the thrilling achievement of Spring Awakening. The show is currently at the Eugene O'Neill Theater at 230 West 49th Street, and I'm very pleased to welcome now to my show Stephen Sader, who wrote the book and lyrics, and Duncan Sheik, who composed the music. Hello.
Hi.
Stephen, you said you always felt that Spring Awakening was a rock opera just waiting to happen. Well, at first glance, that might not seem apparent to too many people.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I knew the play, you know, obviously, and I love the play, which is, you know, the original play set in 1890s, and it's so full of the unheard cries of young people. And I guess Duncan, it was very important to Duncan when we first began talking about creating a piece of theater that he creates something where the music was relevant to kids' lives today. And it just struck me as a great conjunction that, you know, that the place that kids have found release from an expression of those same cries, those same longings for the past generations has been pop music.
So from the start, you knew that you were going to have stay true to Frank Wedekind's time and setting in a small German town in 1891 and have the actors speak in a kind of modified version of formal 19th century dialogue, but that the music would be very much today?
We always knew that the music was going to be modern. Initially, we toyed very briefly with the idea of setting it maybe, let's say, in the early 60s or kind of late 50s, McCarthy era America or something like that.
But well, you could still talk about sexual repression in a way that would seem silly today.
Exactly, yes. Right. But then I think we all realized that there was a kind of a richness and a kind of a fascination with that environment of Lutheran Germany of 1891 and the way where you had a lot of different cultural things going on. I think you had both the kind of repression of the clergy and the kind of society, but it was the beginning of like free love movements and there were lots of different cultural trends that were happening at that moment, which makes it a really fascinating
time. Industrial era, really, the birth of the
Freud.
Industrial era.
I mean, Freud comes along 10 years after Wedekind, doesn't he? Interpretation of Dreams.
He does. The other thing is that we felt that, you know, this was 1999, and we thought it was a great way to tell. We didn't know it would take 8 years, but it was a great way to tell a millennial story, to talk about the century we'd been through and talk about the century ahead. And, you know, in the wake of the shootings at Columbine, it felt all the more urgent. And honestly, who dreamed then that the play would feel all the more timely now?
Well, you said it. Nobody knew it was going to take this long. This is a play that, or a show that could have happened anywhere along the line over those 8 years or so.
We had
what 9/11 was the first problem.
Well, we had productions announced at the Roundabout, and we had to postpone a couple of times because of our director's schedule, and then in the wake of budget cuts that hit after 9/11. The production fell apart, and what we were told was that no one wanted serious material anymore. People wanted lighthearted fare, and I think it was just hard for people to understand the show and what our aims were, you know, with a script with German names and a rock CD.
Well, let's talk a bit about the rock, Duncan. Mm. And it is scored for a rock band. Mm-hmm. It feels at times like as much like a rock concert as a Broadway musical. Well, but your background very much has been in the pop field. You've had some hit songs on the rock charts. Everybody will remember Barely Breathing, which I think holds the Billboard record for 55 straight weeks as a single.
Yeah, it was much far too long.
And 11 million sold, the biggest selling single of all time in the United States.
That may be hyperbole, but
oh, well, that's what the press material.
Oh, they really? It would be nice if it had sold.
But had you ever
did
you ever think of writing a musical?
You know, I had done musical theater as a kid, and I kind of acted and played in pit bands when I was in high school and college. So I was always tangentially involved in the theater. I wasn't part of the theater clique per se, but I did, you know, work in the medium a little bit. And so after I made my kind of first two records and Steven and I met, I did feel a certain amount of, I was disillusioned in a way with what was going on in the music business, especially at that time when you had Backstreet Boys and Britney Spears and NSYNC. It was like really pop music. And, the music I was doing, you know, you could call it pop, but it was orchestrated and it was sophisticated and it had,
You're worried about lyrics.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, you want every aspect of it to be, you know, unique and really quality work. And so it did seem like, well, here's another medium that where there's a, the field is wide open because there's a lot of things you could do musically in the musical theater that it wasn't being done at all.
Well, do you see yourself as a Broadway musical composer in a line that includes people like Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and George Gershwin, Richard Rodgers, Stephen Sondheim, Kander and Ebb?
I mean, I have nothing but respect for all of those composers. And in fact, since I've been working in the theater for the past 8 years, I've grown to really love so much of their music, and I'm kind of always learning more and more about it. But, you know, I do come from a different tradition, and it was important to me to express my own aesthetic in this piece. And Stephen Sondheim came to our show, and he seemed to really like it. So I think, you know, even people from the kind of quote unquote traditional musical theater world everyone was excited to see something that was, you know, pushing boundaries and progressive and taking a different approach.
Well, Stephen, people I think have been surprised to see just how much of appeal the show is for younger audiences, the people who usually don't go to theater these days. But there is a parental discretion is advised notice posted on the box office window.
Yeah, there is. Although I have to say my kids grew up listening to it and my kids have attended it again and again. And I know a lot of parents who have brought their children who have been really moved by it. But I think it's case by case. It depends what what you feel as a parent. Certainly one of the deep messages of the play is that, you know, we don't gain anything by hiding the facts of life from our kids. So it never troubled me to bring my kids to it, but they were aware what they were getting into.
Is there going to be a parental advisory warning on the Broadway cast album?
There is. I don't know if it's parental
advice. That's because of lyrics.
It's because of the
lyrics.
Yeah,
well, the FCC regulations prevent us from even mentioning the names of some of these songs.
Yeah, well, there you go.
But let's face it, those words are used in the culture everywhere, so this is not...
Yeah, and by young children.
We're not being that transgressive. You know, it's just the fact that it's on a record.
My guests are Stephen Sader and Duncan Sheik, the writers and composer of... The writer and composer and... lyricist of Spring Awakening, now on Broadway at the Eugene O'Neill Theater. You've said, Duncan, that you were influenced by how Björk used music in Lars von Trier's film Dancer in the Dark. How did that apply to this? Because songs are used differently here than they are in traditional Broadway musicals.
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, you know, stylistically, you have Björk, who is this, you know, incredibly kind of modern electronic composer and performer singing these songs that with this kind of incredible choreography where it's as if they're like these kind of staged set pieces or show pieces. But when the things she's singing about and the way the song happens, it's really deepening the emotional landscape of that moment. And I, you know, for me, that those songs aren't really forwarding plot. They're just they're it's like her fantasy world that kind of comes alive in that moment. And so, you know, I think our convention in Spring Awakening is very similar, where all of a sudden the scenes, you have this kind of starkness of that environment that they're in. And then when the kids sing, that you're in the, you're out of time, you're in their fantasy world. You know, neon lights happen and microphones come out of jackets, and you get to see kind of what's in their heart.
Well, we get their interior monologues. The songs wind up being what they're really thinking in most cases.
That was one of the first ideas we had in working on the show, was that the song... When you asked me when I first thought of the play, part of it had to do with when Duncan and I talked, and Duncan mentioned... never liked it in musicals when people were talking and then singing and then talking, and it seemed arbitrary what they were singing, an arbitrary decision what they were singing, what they were talking about. And that was one of my first thoughts, because I didn't want to write a conventional book of a musical. And not to put that down, because I think there's some tremendous ones, but I wanted to write a play that was a great sort of rich classic play, because that's what I care about and come from. And so what our thought early on was that the songs would function as interior monologues, that time would sort of stop, you would go into the heart and mind of the character. And I think part of what was so great about Dancer in the Dark when it came out, because we had already been working on this for 2.5 years, it wasn't like we got our inspiration, it was fortifying to see other people were making similar minded explorations.
But you're helped by being in the theater. In a movie, if you're setting something in Moscow, you have to show shots of Moscow. In theater, an actor can come out and say, well, here we are in Moscow, and the audience immediately goes along with it. And here the audience immediately adjusts to seeing one of these repressed schoolboys suddenly pull a wireless microphone from his jacket and begin singing. You just go along with it. And it takes a while to realize that the adults never sing, only the kids.
That also was a primary decision that we made, that we were seeing that we only went into the hearts and minds of the children. And with the one moment, which is one of, I think, the exceptional moments in the show, when the child in the song Left Behind, the young man who's lost his friend, articulates what he feels is in the father's heart, the father who can't bring himself to allow himself to feel his own feelings.
Now, we also should point out there are other people involved. The show did get how many? 11 Tony nominations?
Yeah.
And that covers everything from Best Performance by a Leading Actor, Jonathan Groff, Best Performance by a Featured Actor, John Gallagher Jr., Best Book, blah, 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 Best Orchestrations and all that. But the choreography is by...
Spectacular.
Bill T. Jones. Yeah. I mean, you know, not just some guy who doesn't know what he's doing. And Michael Mayer directed. You also say that Tom Hulce, the guy who most of us remember from Amadeus, played a major role in finally getting this thing to Broadway.
He really did. You know, Tom, when the production fell apart, which is really what happened, and whenever it was, late 2001 or 2002.
You couldn't get it on, but Mamma Mia got on.
That was for sure. And Tom had seen both of our workshops at the Roundabout and was a real became a friend, of sort of like an unofficial friend of the project, and shepherded us around. And unfortunately, we still were kind of getting nowhere for a long time, but we had Tom on our side. And then when Lincoln Center stepped up and we did the Great American Songbook series in February 2005.
A concert version.
A concert version. Tom was able to raise a lot of money and turn that into a thoroughgoing workshop and then invite a lot of people, which is what led to our production off-Broadway at the Atlantic.
And then it was such a success, got the kinds of reviews that people only dream of, that it was moved to Broadway.
I would say this about Bill T. Jones. One thing that was really extraordinary about this was that both, you know, Duncan, Bill, and I are all from different backgrounds and non-musical theater backgrounds, and we all had strong points of view about the story. And Michael is so experienced in musical theater and was kind of our guide and center, and yet allowed each of us to kind of bring, you know, the story elements we wanted to bring. I think what Bill brought honestly brings a level of genius to the show.
So now that you've had this hit, are you working on other musicals?
Yeah, we have two other pieces. Stephen wrote a play about Nero, which now, what is the latest official title?
I'm just calling it Nero.
We're calling it Nero now. But
it's been through a few incarnations.
Yes. So we did it last year at the Magic Theater, and we're going to workshop it at the Public Theater with a young director named Daniel Kramer. That workshop will be at the end of July. And then we have The Nightingale, which is the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale that Stephen has kind of adapted and turned into this kind of two-act kind of Shakespearean tale. We're going to workshop that with the director, James Lapine, later this year.
And will you be using the songs in the same way that you've done here?
Similar. I mean, it'll be for me, I'll let Stephen answer, but for me, The Nightingale is quite different because it's not a rock musical per se. It's kind of more of a chamber piece where you'll have, you know, strings and woodwinds and kind of exotic percussion and different kinds of, you know, strange, fantastical instruments making sound. So for me, it's a slightly different aesthetic, but I think the songs are used in a similar fashion.
Well, you know, I think that we want to write particular kinds of songs. We want to write different kinds of songs, but for me also, but we're using them differently we're using songs as a different kind of element in the story than we do in Spring Awakening. In other words, kids don't step out and pull mics out of their pocket. Time doesn't stop. We're inventing another way to tell story. We're continuing to explore and try to break new ground.
Well, you've come a long way since New Year's 1999 when you met and wrote. You met at a party and then just wrote your first...
No, I met at his house. We met at Duncan's apartment.
And then you immediately wrote a song together?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we're both practicing Buddhists, and so that's why, you know, we first got together to chant, you know, as Buddhists do. And then we had, you know, after we did our Buddhist thing, we had got into a conversation about our, you know, kind of creative endeavors. And Stephen had a song, lyric in one of his plays, which he wondered what, you know, might I want to set it to music? And I said, sure, it's one song. And then now, I don't know, it's turned into about 150 songs.
Yeah, at least.
You know, 8 years later. But it's great because Stephen's so prolific and it takes me a long time to write lyrics. So it's nice to have this amazing raw material to work with.
Thank you both so much for being with us, Stephen Sader and Duncan Sheik. Their musical Spring Awakening is a huge hit now at the Eugene O'Neill Theater at 230 West 49th Street. If you want more information, you can check out our website, wnyc.org. And we're going out with the Song of Purple Summer. Thank you both again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
But still it stays. The butterfly sings and opens purple summer with the flutter of its wings. The earth will wave with corn. The rainfly choir will mourn. And mares will neigh.
Up next, the forgotten war against Chinese Americans in the second half of the 19th century. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.